Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom." With all that, getting an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. That broadcasts out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of various programs on Time for Awakening and interesting articles that you can read or download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we have a special guest joining us, a young lady that's the head of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School here in Philadelphia. Sister Olubi'i will be joining us this evening to talk about black-on-black violence, or the scourge of violence in our communities, from a young black sister's perspective. It ought to be an interesting conversation tonight with Sister Olubi'i, and she'll be with us to talk about this subject after we come back after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215- 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-hosts, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. It's with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Ellen.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm geared up to really engage in our conversation with Sister Obinye. I think it really is going to be helpful for us to hear how she, on this particular topic, Black on Black violence, how she can assist us in understanding from her perspective and age and engagement. So I'm really hyped up about it.
Yeah, it ought to be an interesting conversation. And I guess before the program is over this evening, we'll probably get a call from Brother Oba to let us know about the event last night. I know it was successful. I didn't get the chance to make it over there, Richard, after I left my place. It was entirely too late. And I know that
I did get a chance to stop by. So it was, in the early afternoon, and also got to see some clips of the Universal Dance Ensemble performance in the evening. But it was really a well received event once again for Brother Oba and his, collective pulling that off.
Yeah, I'll touch base with him if he don't call in this evening, because he'll be on in future. They're always doing something in the community, which is excellent. So if he don't touch base with us tonight, we'll hear from him very soon. You know, Richard, this is an interesting topic of discussion that we're going to discuss with our guests, because we see that this is a epidemic and a problem in our communities, whether you're talking about Philadelphia, Chicago, Baltimore, all of these areas where we dwell have been hit with this epidemic and scourge and plague of violence. I think the combination of drugs, ignorance, and guns have caused this issue that we have and that we're dealing with. But I'm glad that we have a young person on to kind of give us her perspective on this problem and maybe talk about some solutions tonight, because I know that the solutions for this problem is going to come from the minds of some of our young people. Let's welcome in our guest. She's president of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School here in Philadelphia. Sister Olu B.E. is with us this evening. Sister, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
Good evening.
How you doing?
Fine, thank you. I'm nervous.
Oh, don't worry about it. It's just like you sit in your living room and we're having a conversation.
Okay.
Sister Olu B.E., before we get started with the topic of violence in our communities, give us a little background on yourself and the Black Student Union at Northeast High School. How long has it been in existence? Did you start it? I know that you're the current president, but talk a little bit about the Black Student Union there.
Okay, so the Black Student Union, first I am seeing, sorry, you know my name. The Black Student Union, we call it the Black Student Association, it basically means the same thing. It used to be a club for diasporans before, but then we took some time off for reasons like our sponsor wasn't around and stuff like that. And then we came back as the BSA. We had new elections, got new people in, and I've only been president for like 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I am relatively new to leading the club, but it has been really just a short ride so far of just being a visionary, of trying my best to inspire people and becoming more enlightened about my community and how I have a part in changing and effecting social change just from where I am. And that's like what we tell people.
Okay. And how long has it been? You said it was called something else prior to, but how long has it been functioning?
Oh, that's been functioning for years, so about 5 years.
Okay. And what's what's the breakdown? Is it a lot of seniors? Is it a mixture? Is it young men and young women? What's the...
It's everybody. We have sophomores, we have freshmen, we have seniors and juniors, all in different numbers. Ultimately, we want to grow more, but we're starting where we are, and we have everybody from different classes and different parts just in it. It's very, very diverse.
Okay.
Even for like a Black Student Association, it's diverse.
Okay. And do y'all pick certain topics to discuss, hash it around, sort of like a think tank among the students, or what? How is the dynamic? How do you pick certain projects and things like that?
We usually just invite people, like people that are usually like closely affiliated with our sponsors or not, just people who are well versed on different topics that we want to explore to come talk to us.
Okay.
They discuss things with us, and after that we give them a feedback, we ask questions, we have discussions, basically just an open floor right after they present things to us.
Okay. You might want to talk with Brother Richard. He's at the African American Museum, and maybe arrange some tours or even come up to visit. I don't know, Richard.
I actually just Googled him.
Oh, you did?
Here you go.
Okay. Okay. Well,
so definitely.
Well, let's go right into the topic of what is characterized as black-on-black violence. Sister Olu B.E., we see that this is a problem in our communities, and it's been a problem for a number of years now. whether you're talking about the major cities, some of it has spilled over into maybe rural areas where we dwell. The problem of black-on-black violence. Talk about it from a young sister, a young person, a sister in particular. Talk about it from her perspective. Give an overview of this problem and kind of talk on some of the things that you introduce some of the things that you want to talk about in reference to it.
Okay. From a young person's view, I tie it into education. How in school we see that a high percentage of students who are suspended are black. Now, I go to a very diverse school. Northeast is a very, look for diversity. The pseudonym should be Northeast High School. We're so diverse, but the highest percentage of the students who get suspended because of, wrong use of word, improper language, because of just wrong actions, they're black. And that seems harmless at the surface, but when you look into it, you find that it comes from, and I'll use this word a lot tonight, culture. It comes from a culture of just consistent violence. Just it's almost a gene, but it's not now a gene in the sense that it's inherent. No, it's a culture. It is assimilated, and so it affects not just the world as we see it, not just the world of when you grow up and you're 23 years old, you might have a gun and it's not registered and you're a criminal. No, it starts from here. We are facing the effects of violence in itself. And I also want to discuss so many things. Actually, I want to discuss how the very idea of black-on-black violence, it undermines the problem itself. I'm going to discuss all of that. But from a very young person's view, I've seen it as something that is sort of a menace to society, and it almost seems like there is no cure for it. It seems like you meet it there, you assimilate into it, and you become it. And so it creates a wall that a lot of teenagers believe they can't get past, they can't go through, and that's why there is almost a lowering of a reduction of the importance of education on most African-American youths. You find that a lot of African-American youths don't want to go to college, don't want to graduate, are not expected to take hard classes in schools because they're used to a cycle of violence. They're used to a cycle of, I wouldn't be better than this. I'm just going to grow up, be inducted into drugs and a life of crime. And so seeing that, I do want to effect whatever change I can. And I will be discussing how that, on a larger scale, is involved in the discussion of police brutality, how it is involved in the discussion and the real problems behind it, how we got to this point and how we can move forward from it, and how to just, in a sense, solve it, So, yeah, that's what I'll be discussing.
Okay. Go ahead, Richard.
If I can, because you raised the point about culture, let me ask this and how you see as far as African-American youth and violence. From your vantage point, and whether y'all had this as a topic of discussion, do you see this country as a violent country or a peaceful country?
I think there is no absolute to whichever side I decide to be on. There is no absolute to it. It's not exactly an either or. I think it depends on what color you are. Through whose eyes are you looking through? If you're looking through the eyes of a black kid who has had to just, in a sense, hustle for his life, just go through the hustle and bustle of life, life is very violent. If you're looking at it through the eyes of a privileged person who just suits through life, life is very peaceful. And so it's based on the disparity or the duality of experience, of reality within the African the American experience, where there is a side that sees life differently from another side simply because of the color of their skin. And so through my point of view, life is as good and as bad as your skin makes it.
And if I can, I like to back up for a minute, because I recognize through your name and then through your accent that I'm assuming your family is, and correct me if I'm wrong, from Nigeria.
You're right. You're correct.
Okay. And were you raised in Philadelphia, or particularly, or are you, what's that? Yeah. Are you first generation
I was raised in Nigeria.
And the reason why I think that's important, because you also bring a specific perspective to this discussion about Black-on-Black violence, as you see it and experience, especially in Philadelphia. Have y'all had a topic, you know, in the student union, and have y'all dealt with that as a topic of bringing someone in and having discussion afterwards about, you know, Black-on-Black violence in Philadelphia or in general?
Actually, we have not. We haven't. We've gotten around to police brutality. We've gotten around to sort of just Black on the underprivileged of Black people. We've gotten around to that, but not exactly Black-on-Black crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Richard, Sister Olubiyi can give a unique perspective to the students there about her experiences on the continent and here, because it's a common thread that I see, and I just want to get Ms. Olubiyi's perspective on this, that whether you're talking about Nigeria — now, I've never lived on the continent or outside of the United States. But if you're talking about on the continent or here, we see a similar mix of violence in certain areas of the continent, not all. Mm-hmm. And a Black on Black, what they would consider a Black on Black violence. But it's always that unseen hand that you don't see, that the media don't talk about, that's prevalent here and on the continent, is European involvement that starts this, that feeds this, that provides ammunition for this. Talk about it from — give me a little feedback on that and what you think on that, Ms. Olubiyi.
You know, it's weird. I have a bullet points. Like, I have bullet points of, defying Black-on-Black violence. But since we're getting —
go ahead. No, no, no.
Okay.
Go ahead. No, no, no. You don't have to kind of walk it down the way you want to. I'm throwing things out there. I know you'll get to it. But
yeah.
Come on. Just do the way you want. Come on and just express it the way you want to.
It was going to be gradual for me. I was going to ease into it. But okay. So definitely, we see a lot of people. I remember seeing this comment that really enraged me. This man said, you know, we're talking about Black Lives Matter right now, but that's not the problem. And I'm imitating his voice. That's not the issue. You know, let's talk about how there's Black criminality and Black people are killing themselves. That's the real issue here. And so he just undermined police brutality to say, you know, Black people are killing themselves. It's so different.
Mm.
And I thought to say, okay. So let's factor in the fact that most Black people find themselves in rural areas. Rural areas that, let's face it, are abandoned by anyone who knows what's good for himself. Literally. Rural areas have little job opportunities, meaning most of the people who find themselves in that vicinity are not employed. There is a high rate of unemployment, which traces itself to the isolation of Black people, which traces itself to slavery, which traces itself to European colonialism and European supremacy. So let's not make it in quotes all about slavery, but let's come back here. There is a high rate of unemployment in the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there is a study that found that Black people are twice unlikely to be employed as their white counterparts. They have the same recommendations, the same resumes, but they're twice unlikely. In fact, employers sort out names based on whether or not they sound Black or white. So the system is designed in a way that Black people are going to be unemployed. There is going to be a higher crime rate because there is no job. How do you make money? Now, in the cases where Black people are employed, there's a 25% chance that they will not get paid as much as white counterparts. So in a case where you do have a job, you're not paid the way you should be paid. You're underpaid. Crime, of course, is going to seep in. Now, let's not factor in the fact that the way you've isolated Black neighborhoods, they have very little connections to actual job opportunities, to actual money-making ideas. And so there's very little emphasis on education, because you have to make what's left of you. How do you eat? How do you think of reading when you can't even put your head down and sleep, when you have nowhere to sleep? There is all these factors in. The factor of poverty, the fact that most prisons are closer to rural areas than they are to urban areas, the fact that Oh, so much. In fact, the tobacco factories, they profile their locations to rural areas, and you see that things like weed and drug and poverty and crime rates will increase. And it's not because black people are just black. It's because the system has conditioned it in a way that makes it very hard for black people to survive. And so black-on-black crime is almost inevitable. What else do you expect them to do? We face it with the idea of, you know, black people are just a menace to society. They're just black. Oh, my God. Just black people. So much trouble. But no, what more do you expect when you deny people the opportunity to work? You deny people the opportunity to even express themselves. And then you now say that is enough justification for them to be killed by the people that are meant to protect them. You know, now back home, and I say home very loosely, back home, there it's not to say that there is an absence of crime in Nigeria. No, there is, but it's called crime. The idea that, oh, you know, black on black crime, it just makes it like, oh, you know, black people like killing black people. And so it becomes a black problem. Crime becomes a black problem. It increases this criminal myth that follows black people. And that's why, and that is in essence the core of police brutality. The fact that you see a black boy, you don't see a human being, you see someone wielding a gun, you shoot him. And it's just, there's this interconnectivity of it. And I agree with you that, of course, things like this always have a hand. They always trace to or date back to European movements and colonialism and slavery. And it always has to go back to there because that is where the real problem starts. That is the real discussion we should be having. It's not, because ultimately black-on-black crime is crime, and it is due to poverty, and it is due to unemployment. And these are problems that the government has made to be a black community problem, not an American problem. And there's just, I'm sorry, I took off your time. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
And, you know, I wanted to ask you, Sister Lubinyi, with that said, and you mentioned about Northeast being a diverse school, and you raised the point about and we're just having a conversation. So you raised the point about, you know, just the poverty and being one of the driving factors or jobs, and I'll just focus on that for this question. In your student body, since you've been there, mm-hmm. have you engaged or experienced young people or a young person who has expressed, you know, the thought you just conveyed in relationship to their particular struggle, specifically because of living in a particular, you know, neighborhood, which is considered a low income or poverty stricken or violent environment? Have you had the opportunity to, or you and members of, you know, in the short time you've been a part of the association, had opportunities mm-hmm. to experience someone who, you know, kind of gave their story, male or female?
I have. I remember, now it wasn't exactly within or because of the BSC. I think it was outside of it. I was talking to one of my friends, and he wouldn't stay in school. He wouldn't stay in school till like 6th period. We have 7 periods in a day. He wouldn't stay till 6th because he said he had to get to a job. The job was, of course, not an actual job. It was just a meager work. He had to do it because there was literally nowhere he would put his head. Literally, this is an actual story. There was literally nowhere he would put his head that night. He wasn't sure where he was going to sleep. I said, what of your father? He said, I don't have one. I mean, you have one. Of course, you're made. What do you mean you don't have one? I was like, oh, I haven't since I was born. Your mother, she's not in the picture. And so he works for himself. He fends for himself, basically. And the job is not exactly, oh, here you go, have $15 an hour. No, it's like six. And that's how he lives.
This is someone you went to, that's a friend that of the same age, and you're seeing how they have to experience and deal with their life.
Exactly.
And how do you see that tying to, and it may not be this person, but tying to the violence among young people? And I think you kind of elaborated on already, but how do you know, hearing that story and seeing this experience, what does that say to you as far as what we go through?
What we go through as a race?
Yes, and as a young person.
as a young person, my biggest concern for him and a lot of people that I know who go through similar things is education. The truth is, because of all these things, no young person should have to go through that. No young person should have to go through the thought of sending for themselves or being homeless. No young person should have to go through that. But the fact that they have to go through that changes their priorities. And so they're not thinking, oh, you know, education is the best legacy. Get education and your life is better. They're thinking, how do I go from one meal to the next?
Mm-hmm.
The priorities change. And it affects, because in the end, what you, if you live a life going from literally one paycheck to another at this type of age, you're not going to be far off when you're older. You're basically going to be bouncing from paycheck to paycheck and probably end up homeless in the nearest future. Unless, of course, you turn out to be Cardi B or something. Like, and that is very rare. That is like 1 in 1 million people. And so in my, I think about like the long run. In the long run, you're not going to be much better. Your child will probably not have a better chance than you are having right now. And I'm referring to my mate, my friend, my colleague who's going through this. It changes the focus of education and the possibilities that education offers. It takes the focus of that to just the now. How do I survive the now? And I'm very, very grateful. I'm grateful for my mother who houses me and feeds me and takes the burden of all of that. I can't imagine what I would go through if I had to take that upon myself. I can't imagine. And so in my head, I'm thinking not only... And let's not even factor in the fact that most of these people come from families where this is what they've seen their parents do. This is almost a copy of what they've seen their parents do. And so they're sort of emulating it. And what they are is they're not creating a cycle. They are just proving the cycle, in a sense, the cycle of you don't earn more than what your mother earns. You're probably just going to earn a few cents higher. That cycle of you're not going to be better than what you... They're basically repeating what their parents, what they see around them. And the violence ties into it in the sense that because of this, and I'll say culture again, this culture of, you know, not really caring about school, which ties to poverty, the culture of, I know people who, there have been fights in school where you find that someone had a gun on them, fights outside of school, you know? And it ties to poverty. And you see these things that seem like, you know, big problems for big people, they are actually manifesting themselves in youth. They have been like, just this year, I remember someone who got into school and she was suspended. Like, we got into school today, she was suspended, I think, 2 days later. Suspended. Just, do you know how much you have to be inclined towards violence to have that kind of record? And then there is now the... Because of it's so cyclical. Because of the idea, because of the culture of not caring about education, it continues. The suspension continues. The violence increases, and school is not doing much to take care of that because you just come to school to learn. You're not really building character. You're not building what it means to actually be a person. You're not building much. You just come to school to learn, and there's really no emphasis on that for you. So you go back home, back to the violence, back to the poverty, back to not caring about an actual future or building an actual future, and that's the real thing here. It's that the black-on-black violence, young boys see their brothers do it. They learn to do it. They bring it into school. It affects their education, and they are not going to get better. They're not going to get past it. And of course, my emphasis is always going to be on education. I'm sorry, I took up your time again.
Which is valid. And Elliot, you know, I'm glad that she's raising the perspective. But, you know, Sister Olubinyi, the question comes to my mind, which hopefully is the other side of it, in relationship to, okay, and you had someone express and you got to share what they shared with you, how they're dealing with being homeless. Well, I'm wondering, is there students or young people that you have been able to communicate with who express that? Well, black on black violence is the reason why there is black on black violence is because black people, they're responsible for it. So I'm asking, have you experienced young people who have that point of view, young black people who have that point of view? And what is that conversation amongst y'all, or how do you internalize that thought?
Yeah,
of a person expressing the reason that people are engaged in violence is because they're the cause, they're the perpetrators of mm-hmm. that experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's very funny how like the person I had this conversation with was actually a Black person.
Mm-hmm.
Very ironic. But she was, rather is, she is very, you know, upstanding. She values education. She puts in work. She puts in effort. So, I understand that from her perspective, she thinks, you know, if you know what's good, just do it. You know that you should be in school at this time. You know you shouldn't get in fights. You know you shouldn't have a gun at this age. You know this, you know that. So do it. Because that's how she's been raised. She's Haitian. And so a Haitian heritage doesn't, or more likely, more precisely, her parents don't allow her to, you know, just be a rogue. They have, you know, values of discipline, values of responsibility and things like that. And so when she sees other Black students acting out in court, she just says, why are you doing that? You know, you can do better. You're filling up a stereotype. It's your fault. You can do better. And I feel like I now have to conform to your stereotype that you now create. And I'm looking at her like, well, you know, the only reason people make decisions, you can only make as much decisions. Your decisions are not they're not better than how much you know. They're not, you can't do better than what you know how to do. And so a large part of the wrong decisions that youths take is because of a miseducation that life has given them. And by life, I mean the realities they are born into. I remember telling her, you can't just say, oh, I have this upbringing. The truth is she has a different upbringing. They have a different upbringing. She has lived a life where, you know, 3 square meals a day. Daddy's there, mommy's there, you have emotional support. You have been given a system of, oh, if you do well in school, you get this. If you do well in school, you get this. They don't have that. Their priorities are different. You can't just throw out and say, and of course the truth is every man is responsible for his actions. Ultimately, that's why people go to jail, because you did it. It's your actions. But what led to the actions? Nobody ever really talks about that. Nobody ever really talks about why did he have a gun? Why did he rob a store? Was he feeding himself? Did he have enough money on him? Was he hungry? Nobody ever talks about what led to him doing this. What was not his motive? What was his inspiration? What led to it? Why is this happening? But we're very quick to just administer all of that. And I spoke to her about it. Of course, she didn't agree with me because, well, again, culture is hard to break. She just like, okay. I said, okay. But you have to factor in the fact that they were raised differently. You are raised differently. And how it's not so much that it's not their fault, but they can be better, but they don't know how to be better. This is as much as they know how to do.
You know,
and that's where,
you know, I was going to say that, Elliot, you know, mm-hmm. we have adults, and I wanted you to understand that too, sister, what you just described in the friend and their point of view, and mm-hmm. your response is good. There are adults mm-hmm. who make the same accusation that the responsibility for the violence is the perpetrator without actually understanding the things that you raised, that their circumstances mm-hmm. could be involved. It's not mm-hmm. an excuse, but mm-hmm. we have to deal with that reality. And Elliot, I just wanted to, you know, it's just interesting that we see how this young person becomes later an older person who mm-hmm. we now see who has that point of view of mm-hmm. that our response, you know, the individual responsibility that for Black on Black violence. I appreciate that. Appreciate the insight you just gave.
Thank you.
Sister Olubi, I want to play a clip for you because you raised a couple of things in your conversation here when you were talking about the family dynamic and mm-hmm. and cultural differences, but you mainly mentioned about the family dynamic, and you told the story of the young person, one of your schoolmates that basically didn't have a place to stay. His mother and father wasn't in the picture. Mm-hmm. I want to play a clip for you, or play a clip for the listening audience. And it deals with some of the things that you're talking about, but I want to see whether some of these things are pertinent to what you're dealing with. This is from one of our deceased elders, Dr. Francis Quest Welsing, talking about the family dynamic and some of the things that are affecting Black people. Let me get this put this together, Richard. Hold on a second.
If you take, you know, if you take one father out of a neighborhood, do you see, then the child who doesn't have a father can make up the difference with the other fathers. Mm-hmm. But when you take 90% of the fathers out by a dynamic, do you see, you have really crippled the entire people. So that when the father is removed and he cannot play the role as breadwinner, and the mother play the role as, you know, the support giver of the emotional well-being of the children, then you're going to produce certain kinds of behavioral aberrations. If the mother is forced to be the breadwinner as well as the giver of emotional supports, do you see, mm-hmm. then the emotional supports go wanting. You can produce depression. Do you see, if a mother, you know, if that balance is not there, the father as the breadwinner, the mother as the primary emotional support of the developing child, if that's not in place, then you can produce symptoms of depression in children. Now, if children are depressed, these are some of the things that they will do. If children are suffering depression and dependency deprivation, they will become preoccupied with sex prematurely, and so therefore we get teenage pregnancy. They will not have the necessary emotional supports to tackle academic work, so we get school dropouts. A sufficient degree of depression, somebody says, well, here, if you drink this, you won't feel so bad, little boy. Or if you take this drug, you won't feel so bad. You'll feel real cool. Do you see? And so that's the way I say that we get teenage pregnancy, we get school dropping out, and we get use of drugs. If you take large numbers of fathers out of a community and male children do not have fathers to model their behavior after and to lean against so that they gain strength and confidence in themselves as male children, then you will have children forming together in gangs. Uh-huh. You see, engaging in destructive activity. So I see that all of these plays are, do you see, coming about because the white king is, you know, in our analogy. Uh-huh. Do you see, put the black king in check. And black people have not understood these dynamics, do you see, or they knew something was happening and they were begging for it to stop, do you see, but it can't stop. And so I say that now, once we make this analysis of what the dynamic of white supremacy is really all about, then we have to go into certain kinds of behavior formation. And one of the kinds of behavior formation is because, see, now we have an epidemic of teen pregnancy. And there's no way in the world that a teenager can rear a child to emotional maturity. You see, that's not possible. If you,
I want to stop it there because she raised a lot of things that you touched on, Sister Olubi. Let's go back and kind of put the what the Elder Francis Quest Welsing said about this whole dynamic as far as an effect in the family, and it comes from the system of white supremacy as a loaded gun aimed at the black community. Unless we go back and do what you're doing, even at the level that you're doing it at Northeast High School, unless you establish these think tanks where these issues can be discussed and solutions can come up with and solutions be formulated, then we'll be like on a merry-go-round going round and round. But I'm glad that these discussions are being had, and you're doing them at your level, and we see these discussions happening at every level, because the solutions that's going to come from the minds of young people in reference to this, it's got to be. These things were put upon us. We have to develop defense mechanisms, like Dr. Welsing said, to combat this. If you look at the system that we live under, Sister Olubi, about 100 years ago, and I'm talking about in the United States, you had a dynamic where black folks were poor, and we might have been about maybe 50 years out of chattel enslavement, But we had barter systems, we had family unity, and it was more of a care among our people, one for another. Mm-hmm. But the dichotomy was, in white society, it was totally different. You had a dynamic of rich or ultra rich and very poor, to the point where you had, in these cities, the scourge wasn't so-called black-on-black violence. It was white violence. And they glorify it now, whether you're looking at Capone on TV or the different gangsters, Lucky Luciano. All those people was terrorizing cities and slaying people all in broad daylight. And it was because you had a large population of whites that didn't have anything, and they wanted to take what the other folks had. So then you had a president that came along in the 30s, and Richard, you can and attest to it, that came up with a Marshall Plan, basically for white society, the WPA and things of that nature, where it created a middle class for white folks. Some black folks did get into that so-called club, so to speak. I'll use that as a loose term. But the middle class for whites was created. It was created during that period. Before that, you didn't have a middle class. You had mostly poor whites and rich whites. And they seen what it would cause in society. So they flipped the script and put it on black folks, where we were jobless. We didn't have businesses, and a lot of some of that might have been to our undoing. But these things are systematic, and until we can get our people to understand it, then we can come up with solutions to fight against it. Give me your opinions on that, Sister Olubi. Or even even have to give me opinions on what I said. just weigh in on some of the things you heard Dr. Welsing talking about in relation to your topic.
I think it's very profound. I was doing some research on this topic, and it's profound how everything connects to each other, and you never really see it until you do. I was really just, I got hit by the family dynamic, and how I remember talking to a girl, and the truth is, that aside, I remember talking to a girl who, her mom died. Her father wasn't in the picture as well. Of course, she was black. I know there's this stereotypical joke that follows black people. You know, we like chicken, we don't have fathers. You know, there's that joke. You're like, oh, is your father around? And people make jokes like, oh, I guess I'm black. My dad's not here.
Mm.
And it seems just like, oh, it's on the surface. Don't be picky about it. But the truth is, beneath that is, like she said, a dynamic where now the mother bears both emotional and financial, and all the burden of both parents is on her. A child grows up, a son grows up, watching his mother fend for both his sister and him. And he subconsciously learns that fathers are not meant to be in the picture. He subconsciously understands that being a father is not shoes you ever have to feel. And then he grows up and he does the same thing. He leaves his children and becomes a cycle again. You know, and of course, when you leave children, let's not forget that this the reason why, oh my God, it's so weird how the reason why this kid is probably going to grow up and probably leave his children because he's going to join a gang, obviously, because the father's not in the picture. This doesn't always happen, but he's going to, you know, be depressed, lead to this, lead to that, and then he'll grow up to be, in quotes, a deadbeat, in quotes. But he didn't just become a deadbeat out of choice. Events led up to it. The dynamics of family relations led up to it. Him becoming the very thing that he didn't see, in a sense. And so it's just how in creating an absence of fathers, we create more absence of fathers in the course of time. And it's not going to be intentional. It's going to happen because that's what will happen when a father's not in the picture, when a mother's not in the picture. They become a nuisance.
Mm.
Your father being a deadbeat, so sorry, because his father was a deadbeat as well. It's cyclical. It goes in cycles, and it's profound. It's very profound.
Richard, let me follow it up with this, and then I'll turn it over to you. Sister Olubi, you mentioned that the young lady they made a joke about her father not being around, or it was a kind of a running joke. In your interactions, either in the Black Student Union, Black Student Association, or talking with your peers, do you notice a difference in young ladies' behavior? Because Dr. Welsing was a psychologist, and she talks about it from the aspect of the mind and behaviors. Do you notice a difference in young ladies that don't have a complete family dynamic and the young men, the differences in how they respond to situations, how they talk to one another? Do you notice any difference, or is it basically the same?
I do notice a difference. The thing is, though, that it is, as you're saying it, that it's off clicking. I guess that's what I've noticed. Like, a lot of girls who, in a sense, have both figures are usually more confident in relationships.
Okay.
Really. They're, and very weird, they're sort of like in a daddy's girl kind of way. They're usually more confident in relationships. I've seen my friends who come to games, like basketball games, with their fathers and their mothers. And the girls, they are more, I wouldn't say expressive, I would say just more, there's this sense of value.
Okay.
That seems almost inherent, that is now lacking on, and is almost a teller. I can almost tell when a girl doesn't have a father figure.
Wow.
Yeah. There is a sense, there is a sense of just validation. And there's just an absence. You know, and so and it also expresses itself in how they reflect themselves, how they're either too seeking for too much attention or seeking for none at all. So I've seen experiences in like self attention. I've seen self patterns in all of those things. I never really noticed much. I noticed the part about most girls that I would find out they don't have father figures. I've seen those. I've noticed those, but I never really noticed it in contrast to those who did have father figures.
Okay.
So yeah.
Now what about the young men?
The young men. I don't have a lot of male friends.
Okay.
Who don't have father figures, but I mean, it's a lot of the people who I try my best to increase my network every day, every single day I'm in school. But a lot of people, a lot of the males I know, and thankfully, I'm really thankful these days, have other figures or don't even talk about it.
Okay.
I haven't noticed a pattern in that. Maybe because I'm a female and I identify more with females.
Richard?
Yeah, you know, I was wondering, well, there's two things. Something that you came up with in the last question I asked, and you said the sister was Haitian, have a Haitian family. And I'm glad that family from Nigeria and then her family from Haiti, and we're looking at the African-American experience in relationship to urban area and violence. I'm glad that we're having that center of discussion, even, you know, because I think that is true to me, cultural or diversity, you know, compared to dealing with what I'm calling the other, you know, because we come out of a same history. But my question is a young person that I'm, you know, interested in, and when we, in talking about violence and knowing, you know, this Black on Black violence is projected in our community, I'm wondering, is there amongst young people a sense of fear based off of what they hear about Black on Black violence or what they have seen that is recognizable to you? And how do you describe that? I mean, is it something, is it a visible or is it an invisible understanding about fear of what's being projected around Black on Black violence?
That is such a profound question, sir. Very profound. And my response to that is that the way fear manifests itself in a lot of young people in relation to Black on Black violence is almost in the absence of it, it's like, okay, I know I'm afraid of this, but I'm going to pretend like I'm not afraid of it. But, you know, if someone wants to, if someone says something out to me, I'm going to be like, okay, you want to rumble? You want to fight? You know, and so the way they express their fear is by pretending they're not afraid of it. But we see it prevalent in conversations, how when two people can just, they can be talking, like having, you know, just teasing around. And one moment someone says something and the other one knows, you know, I can't not defend myself. I can't be afraid of violence. So I have to say, what did you just say? And so it becomes serious and then they have a fight. And that's why, you know, security members are always breaking up fights and suspicion is high in African-American students. But they express their fear by pretending to not be afraid of it, thereby increasing violence. It's more like this. I know that if I have friends who fight, like actual fighting, actual violence, there's violence in speech, there's violence in conversations. But if two of my friends, you know, want to fight, and I'm a friend with them, I have to fight one of them. Of course, I'm not going to fight, because first of all, I will go to my house and sit down and read my books or eat, because I can't fight. But as a friend of two people fight, I'm expected to join them, because I'm expected to not be afraid of it, because I'm used to it. You know? And so if my friend is fighting someone else, I'm going to join her and protect her and defend her, because I'm supposed to be afraid. Now, of course, I am afraid of it, because I do understand that I can be suspended. I do understand that if this was outside of the school ground, this person could have a gun. I could be shot. There have been fights between our parties where someone have a gun and someone literally just shoots us in the air and bullets will hit somebody else. Mm. I do understand these facts, but I have to pretend like I'm not aware of it. I have to pretend like I have nothing to lose. I have to pretend like I have nothing to lose. And that's how they express it. Now, anyone who knows better should run home and not get in a fight. But the way a lot of youths express their fear is by pretending to not be afraid.
Thank you for that.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Miss Olubi is with us. She's the president of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School here in the city of Philadelphia.
And we're talking
and we're talking about black on black, what is characterized as black on black violence with her, and some solutions that come out of the think tank that she helped establish at Northeast High School. I'm giving you a lot of credit, Sister Olubi.
Thank you.
But we'll be right back to continue the conversation. And again, you can get involved too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We have some callers on hold, and we'll get to them right after this break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free.
Hang on to the world as it spins around.
All our people. Righteous by nature, wicked by circumstance, so we are going to try to save our people. Take control of our communities. Anybody that wants justice, come out of those parties that won't give you justice, and let's have a justice party and set up our own candidates, run them in the cities. Take down the weak, blood suckers of the poor, and cast them out, and set up people that will fight for justice for us.
Because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusions about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion, was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it.
if we are to defeat the European, if we are to master this earth and take back this earth from the European, then we must outthink the European. We must then be creative. That puts the learning emphasis on the how-ness, the how to think as such, and to the use of knowledge as a tool of mastery. So it's a very different kind of thing. As a result, you see, the control and the paternalism of Europeans over black people. You see, the other thing that we must recognize, even if the European becomes good and nice and accepts us and so forth, the fact that he would still be in control creates a what we might call a benevolent paternalism, which still to a great degree helps to maintain this passive mode of thinking and this passive mode of knowledge.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're in conversation this evening with the president of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School in the city of Philadelphia. Sister Olubi'i is with us to talk about the problem in our community of violence and some solutions that they're talking about at the think tank established at Northeast High School there in the Black Student Union. Ms. Olubi, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Good. I want to mention something, too, in relation to violence and get your opinions on it, but we do have a couple of callers on hold. In fact, we have a question that was in the chat room for one of our callers in one of our listeners in Newport News, and he asked about any faculty supports for the Black Student Unions, whether they bring in outside agencies to talk about conflict resolution and the skills dealing with that. That was his question.
Oh, yes. We actually wanted to kick that off by January. We have to write proposals. We're thinking to reach out to a couple of NGOs and some bodies within universities to come to school and discuss things like this. Definitely. We don't have them yet. We haven't had them yet, to be precise, but we're intending to include them in our January, when we come back from January, just to the course of the year, basically. So, yeah, that's our plan for that.
Okay. Another thing that I was going to mention, follow-up question from our listener, it says, can she name the NGOs that are perspective? Do you know them, Sister Olubi?
Wanted to see how we could reach out to Black Lives Matter in Philadelphia.
Okay.
The Philadelphia branch. That's really the one on my mind currently. I think the major thing that I would love for whoever we do reach out to is going to be to discuss basically the black youth's place in society when it comes to things like police brutality, gun violence, and how to navigate through that. We know that you're more likely to be shot or killed for things that would other races probably get a pass on. And want to see, what do you do if you were in a position where you could be potentially hurt or just hurt, basically? How do you navigate through that? That has been, I think that was one of the manifesto, one of the parts of our manifesto, something about how we are America, how we all deserve equal representation, but how do we navigate through this current socio-political climate? How do we navigate through that without losing identity, without compromising our voices, and just fighting for equality generally? Mm. So yeah, we don't have any NGOs, so if you can recommend NGOs to me, please do.
We're gonna do all we can, myself and Brother Richard, to with Sister Stacy Nzinga too, so, and she can help you with different folks that'll come in and give you help on a lot of these issues, or at least talk with the students about the pitfalls and things that we should be talking about in this day and time in this society. So we'll be able to, and I can get you a contact with someone involved in Black Lives Matter here in Philadelphia. That would be an excellent resource for you also. So we'll do all we can to kind of help you in that. Let's go to a caller here. Let's go to Marilyn. Marilyn, are you there? Are you there, caller? I think that's Baltimore, Maryland. Are you there? Okay, they may have stepped away from the phone. Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 215. 215? 215? Okay, the 215 must have stepped away. Let's put them back on hold. Let's go to 404. We got two calls of 404. Let's go to 404. 404.
Hey, how you doing, Elliot and guests? Y'all hear me?
Your voice is very low.
Okay, hopefully y'all hear me now. You hear me now?
Go ahead. Say that again.
I say, I hope you hear me now. You hear me clearly now?
Yeah, I can hear you a little bit better.
Okay, my brother, see, I talked to you and Richard about this before, man, on this conflict resolution. Okay, what I've been checking in my study, see, based on sound, but I don't want to get into sound right now. But what I studied is, no matter with who you have a disagreement, it could be anyone. I got a difference of opinion, all right? No matter what, under circumstance, do not go past 3 minutes, okay? That's in boxing, that's why the rounds don't go past 3 minutes. Every round is 3 minutes and they stop. But after 3 minutes, each party will have no resolution and it'll be strictly conflict and fight mode. Now, the same incident happened to me last Friday on the job, man. A brother flipped out on me last Friday at work. I mean, his brother, he was from the military, army, man. We working together. All of a sudden, he flipped out, man, and started attacking, coming at me. But I did not, I shut it down. I did not go back and forth with the brother. I just let him cool off. And cool off, he yelling, screaming. I mean, he doing it in combat mode, man. But I went stuck to the code. That 3 minute rule, it worked, man. I don't go back and forth with nobody or with nothing. If you got a disagreement with your wife, family member, friend, or whoever, do not add food to the fire. Shut your part of the debate down before 3 minutes is up, man. And it worked, man. Okay, so that's just the information I got to share with the family. Even when me and you talked last time, Elliot, about this Martin Luther King thing, I know you was getting eaten up, fired up. And so I just shut it down. We didn't go past 3 minutes. But that's a perfect example, man. So that's what I got to share. And another thing, do not call the police, no matter what. When you shut it down before the 3 minutes up, you walk away and say, okay, don't worry about it. Do not call the police. Don't do it. Okay, we all know all the situations when people call 911. Don't call 911, and that's what I got to share to the sister and the rest of the family, man. That 3 minute rule, it worked, man. I'm telling y'all, it worked.
Thank you for your contribution, sir.
Peace and blessings, man.
Peace. Yeah. Let's go to another call from 404. 404? 404, are you there? Let's put them on hold, back on hold. Let's go to 602. 602?
Yes, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard and the young sister on the line, Brother Marco.
How are you, sir?
Doing great. I'm doing great. Boy, the young sister, sharp like a razor blade. I'm telling you. Cut like a Wilkerson sword. Cut both sides. You got it down fat. The system, you see, black and black violence is a direct result of white and black violence. You see, they set up the system. You see, violence, they don't have to come at you physically with physical violence. They set up the system aware that the result is violence in our community. You know, lack of resources in the community, an inspiring curriculum. You know, so all these things contribute to black and black violence. So the sister, you're right on point. Keep on keeping on. You're on the right track. And a good reference, two good references, Dr. Chris Wesley and Dr. Amos Wilson. They narrow it down to the point where we can actually have some solutions. keep on doing the great work, sister. You could play. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
If I can, Ellie, before you go to the next call, can I ask Sister Olubin, you another question and curiosity as we go forward. How do you see history? You know, African and African American history assisting in dealing with this. Either the discussion about black on black violence, or dealing with, you know, coming up with strategies or about black on black violence for as a young person. How do you see and how do you think young people see the importance of history and assisting in this understanding or dealing with black on black violence?
First, I want to say thank you to the man who called. I wrote down Dr. Amos Wilson. I will definitely check him out. Also, I think that history has as a subject, history as history itself, just events that happened. I think history as a subject creates an opportunity for us to discuss things. The truth is, coming from Nigeria to here, I didn't know a lot of things. First of all, I wasn't even familiarized with the transatlantic slave trade. I wasn't familiarized with it until I studied African American history.
Now, wait a minute. Go back over that, Sister Olubi.
I said I wasn't familiarized with the transatlantic slave trade until last year.
So they
I had no idea what it was about.
So they
I
did,
mean, I
go ahead. No, yeah? I got you. Go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Okay, and I mean, I knew a little bit about it, like, from, there was this man from Benin, Jaja Vopobo, who was against slavery, but that was as much as I knew, and Oborumrem Nobaisi, a man who also was against the slavery of his own people. I knew about these people within the African scope. I didn't know about it in the diaspora scope. I didn't know about it. I didn't know so much about it. And so history, in that sense, helped me to not just, to become aware of the reasons behind issues, social issues, and I remember talking to one of my friends. He was white, was a white colleague. We're talking about how ultimately a lot of the things that he was saying, his case was that, oh, you know, black Americans like to play victim. And I told him, listen, it's not about playing victim. It's about being a victim. It's what mm-hmm. we are. We're not. Do you think I want to be oppressed? Do you really think so? No, it's not a choice. It is given to you. It is a chain that is put on you. Even after the chain of slavery is broken, there's another chain that follows the black man. It is when you see him, you don't see a human being and all of that. And I spoke to him about that and I was like, okay, considered on something. But the fact that because I was aware of my history, I could reach across the table, you know, engage in a discussion with someone who otherwise would have thought differently. I changed a mind that day, you know, and so I've been thinking about it a lot, how we can push African American history into suburban places. How the reason why I took African American history is because people literally fought for me to take the subject. You know? Mm. People actually, but in suburban places, that's why a lot of white people are not aware of white privilege. They don't see it. They're not taught, they're not indoctrinated into black oppression. And it's because we seem to think that black oppression is a black problem, and it is, but it's also a white problem because nobody is really free if somebody is still in chains. It's a community problem, you know, and we all, of course, we need to reach the board. We need to, but that aside, history as a series of events helps in the conversation because I've realized recently that history is not really history. It's still happening today, just in shadows. In things like, you see things like slavery, we're still, a lot of African Americans are still pretty much slaves in the sense of, you know, not belonging to self, being prone to oppression and things like that. So history sort of repeats itself. We find that, and Aisha just found this out, that the police right now, the police was actually an outgrowth of slave patrols. And you find that history, what we now call reality is actually a product of history, and it repeats itself. You know, it repeats itself. And so not only does history inform our present day, it also helps us to find a way to navigate through it. We see that with things like, I was reading up on Martin Luther King and his work, and how he honestly believes that there was enough power in each person to create change. And when we brought all of that power together, we could literally move mountains. And how what we really need is a solidarity of people to effect as much change as we want, as long as we put our mind. And that's why things like black-on-black violence really need to be addressed, need to be solved, because as long as we are tearing ourselves, like Scripture says, a kingdom that is divided against itself will not stand. As long as we are finding reasons to, you know, tear at each other, fight each other, we won't be able to achieve our collective goal. One of the biggest marches, movements right now that's really changing things is the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's because people decided to look beyond themselves and fight for a cause that was larger than themselves. And they've had so many breakthroughs and so many victories because of that. And so history for me not just creates conversation, creates a way of changing, of educating, of enlightenment. It also creates a way of like navigating through conflict, navigating through this current climate that we have right now. And that's it for me.
And I think you mentioned it. I just want to clarify the point in relationship to the discussion that your you know, classmates or your age group have around using history. Is it received, especially the African American experience, or African and African American? Because you know, it's true when we deal with the history, as you even raised, it's intertwined. So my question is there an acceptance among your peers, or is it a rejection in dealing with the African American experience from a historical perspective?
I think the acceptance and rejection is not so much as the experience. It's not so much as to the experience or to the perspective. It's how it's as to the conditions that the conversation is had around. Like if I was speaking to a white person and I was, you know, just being like, "You have white privilege and you should be sorry about it," you'd probably be like, "Okay, bye. First of all, be gone." It would come off to him as, "Oh, you're attacking me." And the truth is, there are some things that need to be attacked. We need to attack institutional privilege. We need to attack it. But we attack the institution, not the people. Of course, some people need to be attacked. Like, some people just plainly need to be attacked. But, like, when you present it as events, I'm not accusing you. I'm saying that there are systems that enable you to thrive better than I will.
And I agree with you. And although I'm kind of also looking at earlier we were talking about, and you gave examples of a young guy who has to deal with, finding some income in order to, you know, deal with his life situation. And having that conversation, and I guess that's what I'm asking in relationship to young Black youth who are possibly in poverty or who are dealing with circumstances that are in school or maybe out of school, presenting that dialogue of historical dialogue, is that well received or not?
Oh, it is. I remember so this girl who she was flunking all her classes, and I called her and I told her, see, and so I gave her the percentage of Black people who graduate college, high school and going to college, and then the percentage of Black people who graduate college and get sitting jobs. And I said, do you want to be part of these numbers or do you just want to be obscure? And then she was like, I want to graduate. And in that moment, she realized that her cutting classes, her flunking intentionally, she was going to become part of a number, a stereotype that would affect. And in that moment, I literally, like, she's been in class every day up till now, up to this break. We've been in the same classes together.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it definitely, a lot of people don't think that youths think, but we do. We really do think. And especially when you present education for as much as it really is, how it literally opens doors, for us. When you present it the way it really is, we open ourselves up to it. I I remember my brother, he, and I love him so much. He transferred to my school, and he wasn't doing so well in his courses. And then I was like, listen, you're a black boy. You're probably going to be if you ever take magnet classes or AP classes, you're probably going to be the only black boy there. And I was like, really? I said, yes, that's how it is. And so I said, no, I'm going to make AP classes. And he made AP classes. And when he was there, people were like, you're probably failure. And it was probably the best in that class. And that's what conversation does. It ignites passion. It ignites us challenging the impossibilities and challenging stereotypes and actually creating change by just being ourselves and all of that. So yes, history just plays a factor in it. And whenever I usually use this line for people, do you know the education you're throwing away is what slaves literally died for? Do you know?
Yeah.
Do you know that? And they're like, what? Yes, there was a time when breeding was illegal for slaves. They knew that it would better you. And that's why up till now, there's a high level of illiteracy among black folks because, well, it's not prided upon. And that's why crime and all these things are also high there. You understand? And she's like, really? Okay, I'll take my books more seriously. I'll come to class next time. And it's those little things, those little changes. They do mean so much.
And do you have, and I apologize for it, but you know, your responses elicit these kind of thoughts, and I appreciate that you're able to project, you know, your thoughts, and you know, hopefully, not hopefully, you will, and y'all will continue to flesh out here. But although amongst the adults teaching and support staff, do you think that they or have you experienced where they have that kind of rapport or understanding of the what you're describing? Do those within, in this case, Northeast High School and your perception about schools in general, do you think that the adults communicate to the students that understanding of what, as Black students and Black children and Black young adults, what circumstances we're living through or you're living through? Do you think that they communicate that effectively, those adults and all?
I certainly know teachers who do. And these are teachers who I have watched closely, who I believe to be mentors. I have seen them. I had a teacher this year who, and he got kicked out of my class, but I had a teacher this year who, after school, he wouldn't leave school because he had to go and talk to some kids who came from less privileged schools, less privileged neighborhoods. I'm telling them how to get past the wall of, oh, I can't be better than this. And it would inspire them, literally after school. And I was like, that is so awesome. And I have teachers who tell you, see, you're a black kid, you can do better than this, and all of this. And there's also the other side where some kids just, they're just a pain in the butt. Literally just pains. You should know as a teacher, when a kid is flunking out of school, it's a sign to a bigger problem. It's not doing it because he enjoys being rude to you. It's a sign. It's usually just an indicator of a bigger problem at home, at this and that. And I know teachers who have made school home for some children. I know too. And those are commendable. And they're the ones that make me want to be a teacher. In the future, I low-key want to be a teacher. Because the fact that since some teachers just change so much about children by just teaching them and speaking to them and reaching out to them, mostly black children. And yes, I've seen both of those. I've seen both sides. And I commend those who do. So I commend them just however I can. I tell them, you're awesome. I literally do. And I've seen the other side, the ones who don't care. But, you know, the world is not perfect. So.
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sister Olubi, you know, when the group talks about current events and violence in American society in general, and you talk about young people, and you look at, for example, what happened and how Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, how they were all characterized in the media, even Tamir Rice, and he was only 12 years old, how he was characterized. But when you see young high school age white children that have went into these schools and just unload on their peers, or when you see the young white kid that went down there in the church in South Carolina and killed 9 innocent people that was in the church at Bible study, and you see how they were characterized and even how they were treated, taken to McDonald's, coming out without a scratch, where these young blacks that didn't do anything at all was brutalized and murdered. How did they feel? What was their response in reference to some of these events?
Well, whose response? My response or my friend's response?
Well, both. Well, I kind of know what yours might be, but when you when you talk to your peers at the go ahead. You can give me both. Just talk about it. Go ahead.
The thing though is a lot of my peers don't sort of figure out the disparity. They don't place them up against each other. They sort them out as different events. And so they don't, like, of course, you know, I see it, but like they don't see it as an expression of different standards of laws for different races. They just see it as, oh, this happened. Oh, but did you hear about Tamir Rice? Oh, but this happened. It's like different to them.
Let me cut across you a second. Why do you think that is? Because they don't have the information about what's going on, and they just hear these events and look at them as separate entities. Why do you think that is, where they don't associate these things with anything else?
I think it comes from partly from a culture that, and I use culture, the word culture a lot, a culture that sort of tells them, get over yourself.
Okay.
You know, the truth is, I didn't know much about, aside that, a lot of people are not really interested in, so I was doing a poem, and the poem was about, of course, police brutality and how it's very prevalent in the black community. And this girl was in tears, and I was like, didn't you know about this? She was like, I never knew there were so many. They don't sort it out to be, you know, this, you know, like, it's not like they have a pile of all black murders. No, they just say, oh, this happened. And even though all these people are black people, they don't see it as, oh, all these people are black people. They see it as all these people are bad people, you know? And so they saw them differently. I think it comes from just not connecting things racially. It comes from sort of a dormant racial view, I guess, a dormant view of the world. And it's sort of uninformed view, I would say.
Well,
but that has changed. That has changed mostly because racial activism has increased in school. Civil rights activism has increased in school. And so that has changed relatively. But like some years back, it wasn't so. It was quite different. And some people, I have friends who I just come to school and they're like, did you hear that? Yo, but when the white guy did that, we have those kind of friends. Or of course, I have the other people who don't make that connection. And it's I think it's because of lack of attention, I would say. Largely due to lack of attention, you're not paying attention to it much. So you're not connecting the dots. But when you do have your attention, they do make the dots even faster than you would want them to. And so it's not due to lack of thoughts, it's due to lack of attention. They are focused on other things, like, you know, IG, what's up, post a new story, Snapchat and all of that. And it's just lack of attention, I would say.
Well, listen, I want to make a comment on that, Richard. I think that when you have young people, high school, junior high, well, they don't call it junior high anymore, middle school, and even elementary, that start talking about these issues, and they're unaware of these things, it's not their fault. It's the parents' fault. It's our fault, Richard.
I'm glad she said that. No, not making the connection, like, because we don't. I mean, our really making association is really a part of the process of critical thinking, right? And it's not compared to living, you're dealing from one incident to the next. So your focus is on just what's in front of you, and it's unrelated to what happened recently or what's going to happen in the future, because you're just that. Lack of attention is only focused on now, and it seems. And as you say, Elliot, you know, we adults are not having that, making those connections. So how are young people growing up hearing and making those associations?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take another brief break, and when we come back, we still got some time. You can join the discussion by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Joining us in the discussion this evening, we have the president of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School in Philadelphia. Sister Olumbee is with us to talk about black-on-black violence and how these things can affect our communities and also remedies for this problem. We'll be right back. Join the conversation.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte is just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're joined in conversation this evening with the president of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School here in Philadelphia. Sister Oluyibi is with us this evening in conversation, and you can get involved too in the time we have left with her, because we're not going to keep her too much longer. By dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Sister Oluyibi, you mentioned, I guess about a half hour ago, maybe a little longer, that when your family came here, that you didn't know much about the diaspora and the transatlantic slave trade because it wasn't taught. And that kind of goes to the problems that we're dealing with, the offshoots of these problems. Black on black crime is an offshoot of ignorance. Talk about that, because see, folks here in this diaspora of the United States have no clue basically to what our brothers and sisters deal with in other parts of the country. Whether you're talking about the diaspora in the islands, the diaspora in South America, or even on the continent, as far as their education, I know more and more, I'm becoming more and more aware, and especially since I've been doing this program, that a lot of our brothers and sisters, whether on the continent or in the diasporas, have no clue of our history and our experiences, our common experiences, and they find out later. So that goes straight towards white supremacy and what we're taught, even in these countries. Just give us a little reflection. When you said that these things weren't discussed, what was stated in reference to black folks here in the United States?
Actually, coming to think of it, because of the state of where I used to live, Nigeria, diversity there is different from diversity here. Diversity here is, of course, going to include racial diversity. But that comes was just ethnic diversity, how somebody might not speak the same language as you, but they speak English. But they may not have, you know, the same second language as you. And so that was diversity. That was how diversity was defined. And in terms of the transatlantic slave trade, all that was really taught was just that it was an effect, or it was sort of an offshoot of colonialism. How, when we discuss things like colonialism, colonialism was heavily taught. How a lot of standards for civilization, standards for beauty, standards for, that was taught. The idea of white superiority and black inferiority was taught very well. And we were, but the problem was we didn't live in a society where we lived in that type of reality at that time. We were past it, but we understood that a lot of the things that we had current were because of that. And so the effect was different. It wasn't so much as, you know, and this goes back to just the idea of black on black crime. You're trying to undermine the fact that it really is just crime at its base. But moving past that, so I think the turning point, and I've had this discussion with a lot of diasporans as well. I remember listening to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She said she went to a store, and then a black American said, "What's up, my sister?" And she said, "I'm not your sister." Now, of course, by this she meant, I am African, I'm Nigerian, I am not your sister, in the sense that I'm not a black sister.
Mm-hmm.
What she had now come to realize at the point when she was giving the speech was that she was ashamed to have said that. Because the truth is, we are brothers and sisters. You would find that if there was a family tree, my great-grandmother's brother was probably shipped off to somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually have an actual family here that I don't know of. Slavery connects us all back to roots, and there's an interconnectivity. When we say things like, "What's a brother, sister?" We're not just saying, "Oh, I know you from Adam." No, we're saying, aside the fact that our joint suffering links us together, we also have a common root, and that is Africa. And I think that has always been reiterated. It has always been emphasized back home. Always been emphasized. When I say, like, there is a community that, okay, a black person is just, we're basically the same thing, and none of that. And when it comes to racial, how we saw things racially, I actually didn't know about racial tensions until I came here. I didn't know about racial tensions. I knew about ethnic tensions because that was what that was my reality at that time. I wasn't aware of racial tensions until I came here. And then I started to study things. I get fascinated very easily by little things. And I think the things that first got me to think about racial tension was, I think, the first idea. I remember when Obama was elected to office. Oh, let's first black president. I remember I was so happy, but I didn't know why I was happy about it. I went, okay, first black president, yay! But what happened? Why are we so happy? And then when I got here, I realized the gravity of it. I realized how almost every black person has more doors closed before them. And so it was a big deal. Of course, that didn't mean all racial issues in America had been solved, but it was a big deal. But I remember that growing up, and then books came out on him. I remember reading comics about Barack Obama and how he was the first black president. I was like, yay, so what did they have before? Because believe me, all my presidents were black.
Okay.
They were all black. So I was like, so what did they have before? You're like, oh, they had other, okay, good. And so I would say, I think diasporans will evolve in their mindsets. Anyone who comes here and decides to remain the same in thinking doesn't understand where he or she is. I think that racial relations in America is too big to be ignored. It's too big to pretend you don't see. I haven't had any encounters racially, any racially charged encounter at all. And that's probably because I haven't seen much of the world. I don't think that my race will not be a factor in the opportunities I am offered. I'm aware of that. I'm prepared for that. And
okay.
And it comes to how even diasporans need to be aware of that. Even diasporans need to be prepared for that. And even black Americans need to be aware of that and prepared for that. Because the truth is, it is our reality now. the fact that there is now a connection outside of the transatlantic slave trade that leads back to it shows that there is a need for an awakening, in a sense, and pun intended, for an awakening, for just enlightenment and awareness and an understanding how to navigate. That's very important, how to survive and how to thrive, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I may, you know, sister, could I, oh, I used that word, right, sister? I'm wondering, do you think there is other young people like yourself in your same age group that would be able, willing, competent to share also like you're doing? I mean, I'm really, you know, in what's the word? The emotional word is that I'm really excited to be able to have this intergenerational dialogue and on this particular platform where a lot of us are listening and engaging with someone, you know, like yourself. And I think, and we, you know, Elliot says all the time, and that's one thing he was excited to have somebody like yourself in, to kind of share, do what you're doing. So I'm wondering, is there others as you see that would be open to have that kind of intergenerational dialogue in a public forum, unlike dealing with Instagram and Twitter or Facebook?
Yes.
Ooh, she said yes.
Yes. Definitely.
Because we definitely need it, right? I mean, just in the topics that we were dealing with. But, and the thing on this violence, you know, I guess, well, let me do this because Brother Otis wanted to make sure we created a book or a reading list so far, right? We talked about Dr. Francis Cress Welding. We talked about Amos Wilson. And he wanted us to make sure that we share for us and you and the listening audience, Richard Rothstein's The Color of Law, which kind of deals with the history of how, you know, race-based policy created, and you spoke to it earlier, the condition of poverty, isolation, which creates the condition for violence and violence within our community that we say is perpetuated, you know, or that we perpetuate on ourselves. But the question I have is around the music and video images and perpetuation of violence through those. What are y'all discussion in relationship to that?
I am very, very careful whenever I discuss things like music and videos. And it's, first of all, Fortnite is just, what? So much violence, but okay, let's get past that. But it's mostly because a lot of teenagers, they want to feel like they're their own person. I'm a teenager, and so I know that my mom and I have clashes because I feel like, oh, I know what's best for me, and you can't tell me what to do. And she's like, I'm your mother, shut up, sit down there. I'm okay, sorry. So I'm very, very careful. I don't want to appear religious, and, you know, religious in the context of, you know, I don't listen to music that has, you know, just, that just violent and videos like that. I don't want to appear condescending. I don't want to appear authoritative. And so I'm very, very careful. I find that the truth about it is violence, you know how art is supposed to project reality. The truth of our day is that reality is now a function of art. Mm. It's now a function of media. It's a function. In fact, if you go to black criminality, the idea that every black man is a criminal, it's a function of media. It's a function of black people having roles that are nothing short of, you know, drug lord, you know, weed seller, gangster. It's nothing short of that. And so the idea of black criminality is heavily permeated through media. The idea of black violence is heavily permeated through media. And the worst part is the largest market for each one of these are black people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like we're our own undoing, but at the same time, we're our own solution.
Yes.
And so I'm very careful whenever I have to, whenever I have conversations like that. I usually present it in a type of so you know just you can do whatever you want ultimately, but you know you want to have something that changes your view about the world. You want to have something that I personally don't endorse violent images. I really don't. I don't watch violent movies. I really don't. Like Black Panther came out, I was like, okay, a lot of shooting though, okay. I mean, Wakanda forever, but okay, a lot of shooting, okay. So I personally don't endorse violence. I understand that media plays a lot. It plays a huge role in how we view ourselves and how we view others. It plays a huge role in our prejudice. It plays a huge role in a lot of things. And so whenever I have the conversation about media, I'm very, very careful to make you understand that, of course, the choice is yours, but you want to make sure that you're not throwing your money into anything that would, in the end, affect you. Because the truth is, when you pay for movies that endorse black criminality, when you pay for movies that endorse black-on-black crimes, what you're doing is you're increasing the narrative for black-on-black crime. And what you're doing is you're poisoning yourself, basically, because when it is, the more the demand, the more the supply, and the more the supply, the more the damage to black communities. And so it becomes. And so when people think of it, they're like, really? Okay, I'll just watch a rom-com instead, you know? And you just watch something else, something that's romantic or a scandal. Scandal's a good one. It's a good show. But anyhow, it's ultimately when people see. Nobody will see something and decide to be blind. Like when you open people's eyes to just seeing how they affect so much, they in themselves decide to make a change. You don't have to tell them to not watch it. They remember when they want to watch it next time. Like, okay, I'm just going to watch one and then choose some other genres. And so, yeah, that's how I have the conversation. I open the floor to make them know it's the power is literally in your hands. You're a consumer. And you hold the power to how much damage you do to your society or how much good you do to it by simply consuming the right or wrong things.
Let's go to Denise in Maryland. Denise?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Good evening. First of all, this is just a very refreshing conversation. So I must say thank you. I'm honored to be listening to this amazing young woman. I have two comments about related to music. The first one is that as a woman, as a young woman, one of the things that I would offer is particularly because people are listening to you, people are engaging with you, you have a platform, you have your peers' ears. As I would offer that as women, as black women, we have a responsibility not to be complicit in this sexualization of ourselves. And we definitely are contributing to it. And we have to be able to draw the line and say no. That's the first thing. The second thing that I would say about music in general and its abuses against our community is that, you know, again, when you're talking to your peers, you know, all the points you made are fabulous. They're right on point. But I think there's another piece to it, and that's reminding young people that no one else on the planet is being asked to depict their people, their community, the way that we have been asked to do, the way that they have dangled carrots in front of us to do. And that wealth that is being made by music executives and even by those who personally profit from it in terms of the artists themselves. That money is in no way changing the destiny of our community. It's not changing any conditions. And so we need to really be able to think about those kinds of things when we're talking to each other, you know, young or old. We have to be able to continue to say, you know, okay, wait a minute. Yeah, there's a lot of money to be made. But let me ask you something. Mm-hmm. Are white men being asked to, you know, degrade their women? Are white men being asked to, you know, sell new records about killing up other white men? Nobody is being asked to do that except black people. And it's not because we're special. So those are the two things that I would offer.
Oh, profound, profound.
Thank you for your contribution, Denise. And call again. Was this your first time, Denise?
Yes, it was my first time, so I will be a part of it again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Let's go to Newport News.
Yes, man, I'm telling you, I don't want to butcher your name, but I'm over here saying I'd like to adopt her. I only have a son.
Check you will.
And I want to say to you, I love the fact that you are well-versed and obviously a sponge, because you said a lot of things that are connected to some things that have been going on other platforms, talking about people that come here from the diaspora. The fact that you educated yourself on this, and I tried to send some, I sent a few questions because I didn't want to actually come on here and talk, but I'm so impressed with the fact that you not only are passionate about this, but you're educating yourself on the facts about it. And if there's any way that you can leave an email or something, so maybe can send you some other literature or some clues about some books you can read, like, for instance, the one I was sent in the chat about The Color of Law. It'll give you more background on redlining, FHA, GI loans, the actual history current in the last 60 to 70 years. I'm 65 years old, but it'll help you when you go to educate your peers so they understand the systemic nature of what's oppressing them. I applaud you, and I can see nothing but a bright future for you. I'm going to be trying to follow you as you move along. I don't know where you plan to go off to college or anything. The only other thing I would ask is, are you trying to build an infrastructure at your school so once you graduate, this work goes on?
Yes.
I'll leave it there.
Yes. Yes, I am. Yeah, that is all spot on. Thank you so much. I am honored. I really am honored. Thank you. I don't ever take anybody's praise lightly. I'm very honored that you think that highly of me. Also, yes, we are doing a lot. Actually, thank you so much for asking. There's this campaign called the Beautiful Campaign, and it is basically discussing and redefining beauty standards. We understand that popular beauty standards in America is synonymous to European beauty standards. And it's not just in females, it's also in males. You know, and so you find that we have movies where they're just like five guys, one of them is black, the rest are white, and they just put the black guy there so they're not accused of being racist. And the black guy died, like, in the next seasons, the next episodes. But, like, aside that, what we're trying to do is make sure you understand that there is no one way to be black. Outside of that, there is no one way to be beautiful. The beauty of beauty in itself is that there is diversity in it. And so it is reclaiming diversity and being confident in it, and also inspiring younger people to be confident and to not find any reason to try to change themselves or try to fit into the European standard of beauty, because beauty is relative. You know, beauty is what you make of it. And so that is our first infrastructure, I guess. And the second one is, and I don't know how to get around this, it's the We Are campaign, how every voice matters in America. We really do. And if we can move all voices together, I'm sorry, I have big dreams, and they are weird because I don't think I can achieve them. But anyhow, I'm putting it out there. If anybody can help me to reach out to people, I would love it. I would really love it. But those are the two infrastructures I'm trying to, you know, just build currently. I'm a junior right now, so I have another year to go. Yeah, I'm a junior right now, so I have another year to go. But the first one, I think we should launch by January. We're going to start with a campaign in school and then see how we can reach out to other schools.
Okay. You know what? Before you leave us this evening, Sister Olubi, I want to get your opinion on something because, you know, you talked earlier when you talked about young people and some of the problems in the community is driven by materialism. Mm. You, it's a young lady. She's going to Hampton next year. The one that won the World Series, the Little League World Series, Monet Davis. Now, the thing that kind of gets me or strikes me is I know that she was highly recruited by a lot of popular universities. She was a good baseball player. I think she, they said her fastball was clocked at 100, at 70 miles an hour. And although I don't, you know, young lady throwing a fastball like that, that you know, damage her arm. But, I think she was 14 or 12. What her age when she's in that World Series?
I think it was like 12.
12. Well, I know she was highly recruited by other universities. But she decided to go to Hampton University, which tells me not only a lot about her, but a lot about her parents. Because some people know if they got an opportunity to go to larger white institutions, they do it. But she decided to go to Hampton. Which, again, have your peers said anything about her? Have they talked about her or anything of that nature?
Actually, no, we've not. When it comes to colleges, my mom is very, very broad in her thinking of it. Her mm-hmm. idea is just go get a degree and do something, make meaning of yourself. It's not so much as, oh, how good is the college? How of course, you want to go to a school where they actually teach. But how prestigious is it? No, it's just, so you go to school, but what are you going to do after school? What are you going to do with all the knowledge you have? Are you going to work for people? Are you going to do an 8-to-5? I don't want that for you. So how do you create change? And so it's not, the discussion is not where I go per se. It's not if I go to an HBCU. It's not if I don't go to an HBCU. It really isn't. It's about what do you do with it?
Okay.
And so... And so the discussion now falls into price, it falls into location, it falls into, because my mom will move with me. I'm raised by my mom and I love her. If you're listening, mom, I love you. But like, the discussion is different for me. And I think that comes from, you know, I only just found out about HBCUs last year. My mom doesn't even know what HBCUs are. She just knows you go to college and when you're done, you get a job or you work for yourself.
Okay.
And so... Obviously, that discussion will have to happen. Obviously, it has to happen. I'm looking forward to it because I have some arguments for HBCUs.
Okay.
So obviously it will happen. Whatever my decision is, I know that it will be something I have argued thoroughly with her. It will be something that we've both decided to come to agreement to. We've both conceded on both parts to do. And so I literally look forward to it. I can't say that I am considering HBCUs currently. I am considering them. I'm also considering whatever just comes to me, I will go. Honestly, okay. So yeah, that's as much as I would do. As much change as I think I can expect wherever I go, I would. That's what I will most likely choose.
Well, listen, it was good having you with us, Sister Olubayi, and we're looking for you to be back on to talk about other issues. The door is going to be open for not only you, but some of your colleagues that you told Richard that you know about.
Yes.
So the door is open. And I want to thank Sister Nzinga for arranging this. But I want you to become more involved. I want you to have a voice on Time for Awakening and kind of get your peers to be involved.
Yes, sir.
So we'll talk soon.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for being with us.
All right. Have a good night.
All right.
All right.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I guess we got a few more minutes, Richard. We can kick around a couple of things.
Right.
We'll be right back. With the time left, you can get involved by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your hosts, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
In 1492. You came up on these shores, 700 years educated by the Moors. 17th century, genocide and the gun. Middle Passage blessed to market the Africans in the so-called land of God. My kind were treated hard. From back then until now, I see, and you agree, we have been a misrepresented people. From back then until now, just see my family tree, we have been a misrepresented people. We have been a misrepresented people. In my hand, we invent.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank our guest that was with us this evening, President of the Black Student Union at Northeast High School here in the city of Philadelphia. Sister Uluyibi was with us this evening to share with us her reflections on black-on-black violence and solutions. Richard, I love the idea.
Yes.
I love the idea of the think tank being established there at the school, ideas and issues being put towards other young people, and solutions coming out of it. It's needed on all levels, and I'm glad that she was a part of the program this evening, and I wanted to get her. I want to talk with Sister Nzinga to get her more permanent addition to Time for an Awakening. Get some of those young men and their other young sisters that's involved in that Black Student Union, and plus others that she networked with, to come on and talk about issues, have roundtable discussions, all of those things. I just want them to kind of be involved.
Great. It's really stimulating to have such an exchange with someone, you know, and usually always changes done by those within her age group.
Exactly.
You know, and what recognizing at this time, you know, the supportiveness of it. I thought it was interesting that that in the one question about, especially when she said that having to be careful around the imagery and whatever that music and mm-hmm. images that come across, I think that's really powerful. To understand, like, I have to be sensitive to the age group, even if I don't agree with it, mm-hmm. because of the conflict it may cause. I think that's really thoughtful on her part. And then the other thing, Elliot, if I may, for her to raise the question, I'm glad, because in other venues there's this discussion of continental Africans not being allies, and here she's a good example to the listening audience, to myself and the listening audience, to us and the listening audience, about what as a young person coming to America, coming to an urban area, coming in, you know, the American African experience, what she didn't know,
mm-hmm.
you know, but being open to learn what that is. And I think that, you know, that ties to how do we create allies with continental Africans when they don't know our particular experience? Because what she said was they have ethnic differences, where we have racial differences. And it could be violence based off of ethnic differences in countries like Nigeria, when you talk about Igbo, Yoruba, Hausa,
and Richard,
ethnic groups.
And listen, you know who feeds that? See, right. That's what I'm talking about that so-called unseen, although it's seen clearly, that unseen hand. who feeds those quote-unquote ethnic differences, even though they are brothers, is the same one that, for example, the Hutus and Tutsis. Right. Both of them basically the same people. But in fact, I want to share this story with you, and we'll do it after you make your point. Go ahead.
It's just the understanding that, as you were saying, because that power arrangement is what we have to, making that systemic analysis. But she also raised that point of us realizing we have the same history, and which was interesting for her to, recognize that those Africans that are in the diaspora has the same history. But at the same time, the Haitian young person didn't see it the same way she seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another difference within us that we have to address and be conscious of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you just mentioned about the quote unquote ethnic differences, and I mentioned how the U.S. or Europeans play on that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you got one of the things that made the news this week, besides this government shutdown, because there's wall money allocated for a wall, is troops being pulled out of.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Syria and Afghanistan. And some people not really realizing what's going on. Some people talking about it. Some people giving this administration and Trump credit for it. But you have to really analyze, just like that clip I played in one of the segments when Amos Wilson talks about understanding Europeans.
Mm.
And developing strategies. If you recall that clip with Amos right. Wilson in it, you have to understand the mind of Europeans that if that's true, that they want to pull out of Syria and Afghanistan, it's already plans to go somewhere else. They're not coming home to be a peaceful United States. That's not in their ethos. That's not how Europeans are made up. They need some type of war and conflict. And I want to read this because it plays into what you were talking about the and the sister talking about the ethnic differences. Check this out, Richard. Yeah, this comes from an article, a published report on 2016. The guy that wrote the article is Edward Hunt, and it's entitled "How the United States kept the arms flowing in the South Sudan." Now, when black folks hear about the Sudan, all you see is people hungry, famine, babies with big gas-bloated bellies and flies around their face and things of that nature, and war-torn countries. That's the narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me read this from his published report. During the Sudanese civil war, which claimed nearly 400,000 lives, the United States helped the main belligerent in the war continue acquiring arms through Uganda, a close ally in the region. For years, the Ugandan government channeled arms, ammunition, military aircraft to the regime of President Salva Kiir, according to multiple reports by Conflict Armament Research and the UN Panel of Experts on South Sudan. Uganda remains the main transit point and facilitator for arms and ammunition in the region, former UN diplomat Peyton Koff reported in September. The constant flow of weapons into the South Sudan has been devastating for the country. Not only have the weapons enabled President Kiir to maintain his military operations against his rivals, thereby perpetuating war, but government forces have repeatedly used the weapons against civilians. The continual influx of arms have had a devastating impact on civilians and on the overall security situation in the country, the UN panel of experts reported in 2016. The war began in December 2013 when Kiir launched military operations against forces loyal to his former Vice President Reich Machar. I know I'm butchering these names. Since the start of fighting, the country have developed into periods of horrific violence, pushing parts of the country into famine. In early 2017, about 2 million people were internally displaced, and more than 2.5 million are living as refugees in neighboring countries. About 4.4 million people, or about half of the population, remain severely food insecure. For many years, the United States had been one of the main players in South Sudan. The Bush administration played an instrumental role in the diplomacy that culminated with South Sudan independence from Sudan in 2011. Now, notice that, Richard. South Sudan independence from Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
President Kerr likes to wear the cowboy hat that he received as a gift from George W. Bush. Once the South Sudan gained its independence, the Obama administration oversaw a major effort to create a formal South Sudanese military. Obama, a friend of the continent, a friend of black people. Now, let me continue this article. Before the outbreak of the Civil War, the U.S. government had been providing South Sudanese government with 40 to 60 million in military assistance every year. Hold on a second. Although the Obama administration began withholding the military assistance during the Civil War, it remains centrally involved in the country's affairs, siding with President Kerr in the war. Perhaps most significant, the Obama administration spent years opposing calls for arms embargoes, making it easier for Ugandan government to channel weapons to the Kerr regime. Despite what seemed like strong internal consensus favoring an embargo, for several years the United States withheld support, and an embargo was not put on a UN Security Council agenda. Former Obama administration official John Tenen acknowledged in a recent report. In the absence of armed embargoes, the Ugandan government spent several years moving weapons and ammunition into South Sudan. The report indicates that the Ugandan government agreed to purchase arms from Kerr regime and transferred them into the country. Some of the more advanced equipment that Kerr regime received through Uganda included military jets from the United States, civilian surveillance aircraft from Austria, and attack helicopters from Ukraine, according to the report. But the UN panel of experts, the Kerr regime has used the attack helicopters as a part of a consensus tactical pattern in military operations. Having gained such significant military advantages, President Kerr continuously sought a military victory over his rivals, setting aside repeated calls for diplomacy. In early 2017, the UN panel of experts identified the Kerr regime as the main belligerent in the war, blaming it for escalating the war, obstructing humanitarian assistance, and placing millions at risk of famine. President Kerr leads a brutal regime that continues to murder and plunder its people, according to UN diplomat Peyton Koff told Congress. So we see here that the United States has been providing, I mean, they're tearing up the continent. They've been providing military assistance, splitting countries in half, siding one against the other, and you know that they're in there taking the mineral resources out of those countries.
Mm-hmm.
Our people got to stop playing fools for these Europeans, and some of that sour leadership over there need to be eliminated one way or the other. That's just my personal opinion. Wearing a Bush cowboy hat that he supplied to him. Somebody need to take that hat and ram it. Well, I'm not going to say that because we might have some young people still listening. But, this type of stuff is a disgrace. Bush supplying weapons. Obama, a black man, supposed to be a friend of black people that don't have no knowledge of what he's done. His hands is full of blood. He's still supplying weapons, facilitating them through Uganda. and other European countries getting involved in the action. Ukraine surviving at Austria, providing attack helicopters. Ukraine supplying surveillance aircraft. All these Europeans enjoying all this stuff.
Yes, yes, and now that the, you know, when you mentioned Syria and with his name just leaving as the defense secretary, you know, Trump is and giving the position to ex, I think is a is that it wasn't General Dynamics Boeing, 32-year Boeing executive.
Oh, that's who he gave the position to? I don't know, because I don't really follow it. That's who he gave the position to?
Yeah, just
the, oh, well, you see. I mean, you see what all this is about. You see what all this is about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, McMaster's is, you know, is supposed to be considered the gentleman general, and he just couldn't take it no more. But, I mean, now you got a corporate takeover. I mean, a true corporate in your face. You know, and it goes to, and I'm only bringing that up because what is the possibility of, as you said, is it going to be, you know, and pulling out, is it still going to be selling arms?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, come on. You know that. Listen, Bush and them did the same thing when they had that Iraq war going on. And the vice president with this Halliburton was making money hand over fist.
Mm-hmm.
And then so when it was exposed, and he supposed to have divested his interest in it. Come on, who believes that? And who believed that?
So it's you know, but it goes to, you know, the conversation we were having, and in relationship that this, you know, it all goes back to the history of this country and the history of white supremacy or dominance, right? Maintaining dominance and control. And that for us, you know, the us being in North America, it's about maintaining a caste system, you know, as wealth is being generated for those at the top.
Let's go back. We got the caller on hold. Let's go back to him because I see he popped up back here. Let's go back to 602. 602?
Yes, brother Elias, look, we got to put that a good book, "How Europe Underdeveloped Africa" by Walter Rodney.
Yes, mm-hmm.
That book shows you how the Europeans play tribe against tribe in Africa.
Okay,
the situation that occurred in Rwanda and Burundi was a direct result of what they did. See, they sided with the Tutsi, and then when the Hutu got power, it was payback. You see, this a similar situation happened in in Sudan.
Okay,
and we have to remember, you know, North Sudan was putting down, which is predominantly Arabic, was putting their foot on South Sudan. See. So South Sudan, that's why they split the country, you see. But now what's happening in South Sudan, you see, South Sudan, in North Sudan. In North Sudan, they lift the sanction on Sudan. You see, they lift the sanction on Bashir. But what's happening in Sudan right now? There is unrest, you see, because although they lift the embargo, the price of bread shot through the roof. And if you will, shot through the roof, and right now they got unrest going on here in Sudan. You see, they got rioting in the street and all kind of. They go eventually. They go get him out. You see, because you know. So even when you concede, they still come after you.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so it was better he had stood his ground. Now the unfortunate thing that happened, you see, the Kerr and the other guy in South Sudan. The two tribes, they fought and got, you know, helped push out Sudan. But then they started fighting amongst themselves when they, you know what I'm saying, creating more conflict. But now they're kind of sitting down at the table, and hopefully they could get that that pipeline going again, because you see, Sudan was benefiting from that oil that was coming out of South Sudan, but because of the unrest, no oil couldn't even. China put troops down in South Sudan. That's how bad it was. China had troops there to support the pipeline, because China put the pipeline that run from South Sudan to the port of Sudan. You see, so it's you know, as the sister said, you know, they use, and she said something. She said ethnic, but I wouldn't say ethnic, I would say tribal.
Okay.
Because ethnic, we are black folks, you know what I'm saying? It's just different tribes. You see, in Africa, they're looking in your face to see, well, let me see, you know, where the tribal marks are, you know what I'm saying? But here in the West, we are totally detribalized, you see? And that's why make us so important in Africa, because we don't have no tribe. See, we go over there, we say, look, I'm from all of Africa. You know what I'm saying? I ain't with this tribe. I'm all the tribes. You see? So that's why we have to be at the table also, because they got that tribal issue there. We don't have that problem. See? So we can offer that, you know, we could be the glue. See? That make that difference. That's what made the difference with this black man here in the West. We are totally detribalized, and we have a serious key. To help liberate Africa.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you so much. Goodbye.
Brother Marcus. I agree with that. Only thing, Brother Marcus, I differ in the sense of the ethnic, you know, and over the years, I haven't liked the connotation of tribe, because I think the European gave us that connotation of tribes, and it has propaganda imagery and a history that they have concocted that goes along with that. And therefore, why I like the or I utilize to understand the difference between why I use ethnic and make it more distinct ethnic nations, because each one of those language groups, whether, you know, in this case, the people, and it's interesting because when we talk about South Sudan and North Sudan, we don't look at who are these people who have a particular language, a particular history, a particular social structure, and therefore they are ethnic nations that used to live within those areas until the European carved it up and forced different nations unwillingly to live, to be a part of the same state that Europeans created. In their definition, and they have to resolve that, because that conflict they had resolved before out of their history. That's on the east coast of Africa. On the west coast of Africa, it's the same thing, where you have different ethnic nations that have a particular. They had worked out how do they in geographical area, even with warfare, how did they go about that? So again, I'm only saying the connotation of tribe is something that Europeans have given, but the reality that they are ethnic nations, and they have differences that they have to work out, especially because of your colonialism and European dominance. So that for them is the same as us working out the racial difference with us here in the West.
But one thing though, you see, here in the West, you see, we have a problem when it comes to distinguish between ethnicity and nationality. You see, that's where we run into the problem in this side now, because you see, we say, when a person say I am an African, you know, what make you distinct as an African is your physiognomy, your physical characteristics, our fleshy nose, our full lips, our dark skin, black skin, and our hair, you see?
Right.
But we get caught up with nationality now. You see, because, you know, somebody will say, well, all right, I'm Jamaican. But Jamaican has different nationality. They have different ethnic groups in Jamaica. You got Chinese, whites, Indians, you know what I'm saying? So on this side, we have to, you know, we have to distinguish when you say you are an African, who is an African? You see, you know, you have white people saying they are African, and we know they ain't African.
and that's where Garvey came to assist us in our own historical narrative about through race first, because that makes the distinction for us to deal with that. And, you know, I think that assists, even though that's not a discussion that has to be dealt with outside, that's an understanding that we have to have, whether others like it or not. You know, this is how we unify ourselves as a part of the historical diaspora. Compared to other ethnic nations who have come in and been dominant minorities, as they're calling them, you know, being able to economically exploit places where we're the dominant majority of population, but we don't control none of the resources in those environments.
But that sister this evening was definitely a breath of fresh air. You know what I'm saying? I could see great things happening for that sister. At this young age, with that mindset, you're going to go. The sky is the limit for
you. And it ties to what you said about Walter Rodney, Sikor. You know, those were young people, young military people. Now we have young thinkers. Who are coming from the diaspora and within here, young thinkers who are trying to resolve, you know, as you say, coming up with solutions and taking leadership positions in where they are.
There is hope. There is hope. All right, good brothers. Thank you so much.
All right now.
All right.
We got time for one more, Rich.
Yes, sir.
All right, let's go to 215. I'm sorry. 215.
Yeah, hey, Elliot. How you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
Fine. Hey, Brother Richard. How y'all brothers doing today?
Good.
Yeah, I just want to praise be to Allah. I just want to say I enjoyed the young lady when she was on earlier. She's a very, very intelligent young lady, Elliot and Richard. In the young lady, if I remember correctly, she go to Northeast High School, I think it was.
Yeah, she's the president of Black Student Union at Northeast High School.
Okay. Oh, cool. Okay. Beautiful young lady, very intelligent. And so Brother Marcus made some good points right before I did. Marcus always come with something very good and informative. That's what Brother Marcus, he never have a wasted phone call. You know, people call in to restaurate a lot of time. They call in with talking crazy. And I always say, Elliot and Richard, the airwaves are too valuable for foolish stuff. I mean, it's nice to have sister human stuff here and then light stuff. That's cool. I'm cool with that too. But when you call up and just talk real stupid, like some of our people tend to do, I think it's a waste of airwaves. But anyway, a couple of things real quick before y'all brothers get off. The official Elliot and Richard that had made the young brother cut his dreads off. I heard, fact check this for me, Elliot and Richard. I heard he was Jewish. Did y'all get any confirmation on that yet?
No, I don't, because I really didn't know who did it. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not surprised.
And the reason why I said brother said he heard he was Jewish, and if that's true, like the brother said, he said, where's the anti-defamation? Since black people, Semitic people, where's the ADL? They are so quick to call Mark Lamont Hill and anybody else anti-Semitic. Well, this filthy bigot, if he happens to be Jewish and he made that, humiliated this young brother, made him cut his dreads off, he's an anti-Semitic. You know what I mean? We like the brother said, we got to stop letting these people get, you know, win this battle us, because we are Semitic people. They're not but garden variety Europeans. They're not even no real damn Jews anyway, so we got to start hitting them with that, calling them anti-Semitic. And not only are you anti-Semitic, but you're anti-black too. But let me say this, Ellen Richard, to show you how we got to change this paradigm with this Zionism, how it got control of people. Now, as you know, Elliot and Richard, this past year, you saw what happened this year, this going to be going to 2019. You saw a lot of journalists killed, and one of the prominent ones was Jamal Khashoggi from Saudi Arabia. They got killed by the Saudi royal family. to his brutal murder. And I bring this up, Brother Richard and Brother Ellie, to show you how these Zionists, they got people scared to say who it is. Now, they was talking on NPR today, on National Public Radio, about all the journalists was killed, with Jamal Khashoggi's been the most prominent one. Now, they was talking about all the other journalists that got killed, and it was letting you know who did it. Like, for example, Ellen Richard. And this is why I want the time for this audience to really understand what Brother Joe said, to see how the control that these bigots got over the media. They were saying, well, in Syria, they was killed by either Assad's forces, or the journalist was killed by the rebels. I mean, they let you know who they thought did it. Now, they mentioned about the Palestinian. This was worldwide news when that Palestinian journalist got killed by the Israeli snipers and stuff. That made it was outraged the international community. And Israel was trying to justify it by saying they thought he was a terrorist or a member of Hamas, but he wasn't even there the battle. He was away at a safe distance, you know, during his reporting, and yet he got killed by Israeli sniper. But anyway, when the public radio was mentioned that all the journalists was killed and who did it, when it came to Israel, this is what they said, Ellen, just show you the power they got over the media. They said, well, this Palestinian journalist, his killing was definitely a targeted killing. That's what they just left it at that. It was a targeted killing. Now, they know damn well who killed him. It was Israeli forces. But they were scared to say it was Israel. So they just said his killing was definitely deliberate, targeted killing, but they didn't say who did it. But yet, when it came to all the other journalists that was killed, they let you know who did it, whether it was Saudi Arabia killed Khashoggi, or whether it was Syrian people killed this journalist, or whether it was the Russian forces killed these journalists. They let you know all the other journalists who killed them, but when it came to Israel, it was just his killing was a targeted, deliberate killing, but never said who was the perpetrator. You follow me?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
I mean, see, this stuff is something we just can't see. I mean, this is the power that these bastards, these devils got, that we got people scared to even say who it is, man. But you can say about everybody else. And this is what I was saying, Ellen Richard on Terrestrial Radio to one of the hosts a few years ago. He was on there ranting and raving about how things was in the Sudan, how bad things was in parts of Africa, and which is Sudan is a part of Africa, and how things was bad in other parts of the world. But yet, I said, what about Israel? And me and a couple of calls said, what about Israel? Man, this brother got locked, John. Why you want to talk about the Jews? I said, well, damn it, you talking about everybody else? Who the hell? You can't talk about them? If you can talk about everybody else's wrongdoing, you mean tell me you can't talk about theirs? Who the hell is there that you can't point out their faults and wrongdoing? You know what I mean? I mean, you just get sick and tired of this stuff, Ellen Richard. They did this gutless cowardice, this bending over, kissing behind, and scared to speak truth to power when it comes to these garden variety Europeans that call themselves Jews. You just get sick of this stuff, man. It's enough to, as the brother said, enough to burn you up, the stuff that goes with these people, man. You can't say nothing about them. They can say whatever they want about everybody else, do what they want to do, and nobody's supposed to hold these people accountable. Well, I'll be damned if I'm going to play that game. I'm going to call a spade, damn it, you can call me anti-Semitic, anti-Jew, you can call me whatever you want, but as long as I got breath in my body, I'm going to speak the truth as God gives it to me, brother, and that's all I want to say. I'm going to speak truth as long as God gives it to me. I'm going to speak it the way I feel it. Simple as that. But thanks, Brother Ellen Richard. I'm out, man.
Thank you for your call, Brother Joe.
You're welcome. Peace.
Look like we got one more here, Richard. Let's go to caller.
Yeah, good morning, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Good morning to you, sir.
Oh, what's up now?
How you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. All the better to hear your interjection there. Absolutely, brother.
You're supposed to be asleep. No. What are you doing calling at 2 or 3 in the morning?
You always say that, Brother Richard, but you got to understand, Brother Elliot. You got to understand, Brother, that the work continues no matter what time of day it is.
Okay.
In the real world, we don't follow time. We just do what we need to do. So if the ancestors say it's time to wake, we find that time to awaken. You get where I'm coming from.
Okay. All right.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, I heard Brother Marcus phone in and make that point. You know, great point. Brother Marcus, you got to hit me up on WhatsApp. Send me a message, man. Yeah. I was thinking absolutely, and Brother Richard made the point, which was in my head. It's something which we've dealt with quite a few times in conversations here about the derogatory term called tribe. It was absolutely a term which was given to us by our European adversaries, and it is a derogatory term for Africans. There's no tribes in Africa as such, in accordance with the Eurocentric idea of a tribe. The other thing which I'd like to add is that with that article you read out and information which was very profound, is the other adage is the division between the Arabization of that region and the African, because you've got to remember, in North Sudan, they don't even see themselves as African. I don't think you know, this needs to be stated. They do not see, as black as they are, they do not consider themselves Africans. They consider themselves Arabs. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And that's the other ethnic division which is not being referred to. They consider themselves Arabs, not Africans, despite the fact that they look like Africans. And this is another thing which Chancellor Williams talked about in his book, The Structures of the Black Civilization. Mm-hmm. He referred to this about, you know, this type of ethnic division.
Okay.
So, you know, we need to remember that. And I know this may affect some people in the way they look at, this religion of Islam. But it's the truth, and some people are going to speak the whole truth and nothing but the truth, not just the truth that they want to hear, because some people would like to consider Islam as part of an African identity, but right there in that region, those who consider that religion could consider themselves Arabs, not Africans.
Okay.
You know, brother, I'm wondering, as you raise that, because, you know, the same kind of, my question is about the Arab identification compared to the Islamic identification, because we know in West Africa, Nigeria specific, it's a strong, they organize, their social organization is around their Islamic, what's that, religious affiliation, right? I mean, even though they may be, what's that, Fulani people, they are very heavily identified as being Islamic compared to southern Nigeria, which is more because of European Christianization, they're more Christianized. So I'm raising the question of, and it seemed that the buffer that brought the two together and the power was in Gaddafi, right? So because I hear people say Gaddafi was a Islamic, you know, nationalist or Arab nationalist, but he did see Africa as a continent, as one political entity in which he was trying to bring them together. So my question to you is, you know, just in the bandying around, is there a distinction between being Africans identifying as being Arabs or Africans identifying as being Islamic? Or is that one and the same?
That's a great question. And it's something which I've learned within the last year. I've been involved in something called the IPLB. Are you familiar with the IPLB?
No, I'm not. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's an organization within Nigeria itself. It stands for the Indigenous People of Biafra.
Okay.
And you've got groups, that group particularly agitating for the Biafran independence.
Right.
And being involved in them, it's been an absolute eye-opener for me, because that, say, for instance, is the political agitators for that particular cause. Now, some of them, depending on who you speak to, will say that those in the northern region consider themselves Fulani, especially, or like the Fulani herdsmen. They complain of them openly assaulting them in their northern regions and attacking the Biafran people who live in those regions, murdering them cold-heartedly. And they would argue that they don't see themselves as African. I've heard their words. They say it, that those people up north do not see themselves as African. They see themselves as Arabs, separate from Africans, better than Africans, more superior than Africans, so on and so forth. So, you know, depending on who you speak to, that's how they see it. And then, you know, you have, because there's that obviously Islam goes right down into Yoruba, it goes down into parts of Sierra Leone and other places like that. Maybe those places, they may not consider themselves as Arabs and particularly consider themselves as African, but the more north you go, you find that they really look down on the Africans, despite the fact that they are Africans and they look like Africans. And this is a thing where in the last year, which is absolutely an eye opener for me and shocked me in many ways of the divisions. Saying this, I would love if somebody would invite one of the senior members from IPOB to be on Time for Awakening, because I think we really need to hear some of this information, because I think sometimes the impression we get with this like seeing Africa as one homogenous continent and seeing even within these regions as homogenous is absolutely inaccurate. And it's not until you sit among, and there's another thing going on, which is I see here, I learn from. Okay, in this country, we've got a large amount of people from African, from Caribbean, Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, and so on and so forth, and West Africa. And then what I realize now, even though I have Nigerians in my family, who are Yoruba, and even Ghanaians within my family through marriage, I get to realize now that sometimes when you're in these groups, ethnic groups, you don't talk things which are more personal to you about your divisions. You don't speak them among others. You keep them to yourself. And even though I've got it in my family, I'm realizing now that sometimes when being involved in the IPLB and learning the deep divisions, that it's something we better get to talking about and discussing. We better get familiar with, because some of these divisions are absolutely very deep indeed, and they're hidden, very hidden. Right. So I think it's something where we really need to start, bring out in the open. Personally, I think that's what needs to be done, because I think there's a lot of delusions going about. So yes, these ethnic divisions you talk about are real. And if you look like a black man or an African man, and you don't consider yourself an African, you consider yourself an Arab, then that's a deep problem.
And that's why for those, and Brother Marcus brings up all the time around I think the contribution that that historical moment that Garvey brought, but what you raised, I agree wholeheartedly, and it came up. In the discussion here, if we don't help negotiate, and because that's what's going to have to happen, because they're very insidious. I mean, even the the Yoruba and the Igbo war. I mean, that was a brutal war between two historically close groups, and they still have that ethnic divide.
Absolutely, that's what that is, brother. That is so real. And like I say, within the last year, being involved and sitting down with the people and actually listening to what they're saying, it's been an eye opener for me. Absolute eye opener. And it's more real today than it's ever been.
And that's what gives the. I don't know if the Chinese. And I apologize for it, but you're stimulating this thought, because there's a difference in what China is using in their geopolitical strategy of colonizing, if we're going to call it Africa, and what the Europeans are using. Because it seems that the Europeans are using the ethnic differences in order to get control of the resources, and China is going directly to the leadership of the state in order to get control of the resources, which still gets down to the ethnic differences, because there's ethnic groups that controls the power of the governmental arrangement. So even though they don't necessarily play one against the other, they are still going and giving the resource to those who are sitting in state power or national power.
And let me add this as well. which is another concern to me, and something which I have to be very diplomatic among certain members in particular groups and how I speak about this, because you've got there, like for instance in the IPLB, they've got a man called Nnamdi Kanu, who's the political head agitator or leader in that particular group, and you know, I knew last year sometime, and he was actually kidnapped, or I say kidnapped, but that's what it appeared to me, kidnapped by the Nigerian army or government, and he disappeared. And then all of a sudden, this man turns up in Israel, which I, up to this day, I can't work out how that happened. No one can explain how he was kidnapped by the Nigerian army and put under house arrest or whatever. Nobody could get in contact with him, and he just turns up in Israel. You know, you can go on the internet and see this, bowing to the Wailing Wall, with all dressed up like a Jew. So, to me, that's another shocking aspect. I'm sorry, brother. We have to open up this conversation and start to look what's going on, because I think we're in some bit of a dream world. Because I see this man bowing in front of the Wailing Wall, dressed as a Jew. Yeah, because you know, they've been told that they're some lost shrine of some Jewish organization. Well, we know about that. You know, and they, you know, I know they were Hebrews, but I'm not so sure about the Jews. So they believe that this, and you know, this man has been taking refuge by Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. That's very worrying to me, you know, but they, you know, no, but they think it's some, I don't know, you know, because as far as the argument, they have this argument that none of the African Union or the other countries have actually stood up to them, or even in the Civil War, they abandoned them. So, this, you know, this is very real. And this is something I don't hear from our people talk about, you know. They feel abandoned by the other Africans in the country. And so it seems to me that they're seeking refuge in Israel, which is another worry. That dynamic, I think we really need to be put on the table and find out exactly what's really going on.
Hey, Brother Paul, when you get an opportunity, send me some contacts of some of the brothers or sisters in that group, and I definitely have them.
I will, and I know he'd be. I've had him on various radio stations here, and he's very articulate in what he says. He can explain the whole history of it, and I tell you, he will definitely fill you in. And as soon as I pass on that, you know, that you'll have him. You'll be delighted to come on.
Good. You got my contacts and all, you know. And
we really need to hear this information, because, you know, Brother Elliot, you know, one problem, this platform, and I will keep on saying it, and you reaching out and just allowing me to speak like this, absolutely, absolutely essential. Because one thing I think personally, you know, we're all talking about going back to Africa, right? But in reality, we're not really talking to each other. And I think that's a problem. Because, for instance, I watch human behavior, whether you be black, white, or anything, yeah? If we decide to move into the same house and we don't talk about how we're going to live together, they're going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We better start talking to one another, because we as black people, I don't care. I've lived in America. I've stayed in Jamaica. I have family in Canada. And to me, I'm the same wherever you go. You know, we need to talk more to each other before we make these big plans and we decide to move in. You know, we've got a lot of people here moving in. We've got a place in, a few friends of mine, they're involved in a place called Garvey Town in Ghana. And I heard him say the other day, yeah, you know, we got more brothers and sisters from America being involved in this project and whatever. But the truth of the matter is, you know, there's when I listen to some of the radio platforms and people speak here who've never been to America or just have this understanding of what black Americans are or African Americans are, it's quite delusional again. So we really need to start talking to each other big time. So the importance of this platform, you know, is absolutely important. And I'm doing my part to bring it to the attention of as many people as I can. And that we, you know, we've got to realize that the importance of talking to each other, because we all seem to be moving to the same place or trying to hit the same targets, but we're not really speaking to each other the way we need to speak. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, it's so important. Absolutely. So, you know, trust me, it's you know, nothing happens before its time. And, you know, I will not keep saying the importance of this platform and others like it. Absolutely important, you know, to bring these things and these issues to the table, because, you know, there's a lot of things we need to speak about and talk. We have, we're in the serious times and serious adversaries, you know. So, yeah, we need to have a communication. And for me personally, two things which we need to resolve, the mindset. We need to resolve, and we need communication before we have anything. Because if you no matter what you have at hand, if you can't communicate, then there's a problem. If you're living in the house with your other half, your partner, woman, or whatever, and you're not communicating, that's a big problem. So we're the people we must put this communicate this communication thing right.
Brother Paul, thank you for your contribution, brother.
Absolutely, so keep up the good work and. You know, don't work too hard over your fantastic Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Take care.
Hey, listen, care. Don't forget, pass along that information, and I'll try to set things up.
Yeah. Are you still on the WhatsApp?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. Definitely.
Okay, then. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll speak in the year. We'll speak soon.
Right. Brother Richard. Yeah, we're coming up to the end of another program, and it's always interesting discussion with the audience, and especially when Brother Paul gets an opportunity to call up from the UK and give us his perspective on things going on. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Oh, before we leave, I want to let everybody know about the lineup. We got Mondays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting dialogue and discussion on African Perspectives at 6 o'clock to 8. Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. And from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black, Black365.com with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive is back with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Thursday, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. And then Time for Awakening is back on Friday from 8 to 10. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know, the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah. Save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Be a fireman.
to save the children. To save the children.